may need or want different things during their stay here, so that please, I'm Jean-Marie Ricabres, the director of the chair, don't hesitate to ask anything you need or want, if it's not money, of course, I mean, you don't have money for everyone. As you know, this is the chair which bears the name of Josep Ferrater Mora, a distinguished Catalan philosopher who spent his academic life in the United States at Bryn Mawr College. Precisely in this room, Ferrater gave his first series of lectures of the chair. Ricoeur, Quine, and some others followed him. Ferrater and I, we invited Professor Chomsky to become lecturer of this chair. Ferrater expressed many times his wish to be here during Chomsky's lectures, as he had attended Quine's lectures. Unfortunately, Ferrater died at the beginning of 1991. It's sad he couldn't accomplish his wish. At Professor Chomsky's suggestion, we invited Martin Davis, Pierre Jacob, Massimo Pietelli Palmarini, and Luigi Rizzi to come to Girona for different reasons, and much against their wishes, three of them have been unable to come. In their name, I should greet you all. But Luigi Rizzi is here. I don't know exactly who I am, but oh, he's here. Though he is living tomorrow, so that I guess some of you may be interested in having a session with him. I'm not sure whether it can be a very technical session or a more informal general session. It would take place after this afternoon session, at about 6:30 in the evening or so. How many of you would be interested in a technical session with Luigi Rizzi? A very technical one. What do you propose?
One is a kind of general overview of parametric theory, if not sometimes it just happens as a principle of the parameter. This should be accessible to a fairly general public. And the other possibility is a more technical talk having to do with the definition of alien and bound positions, so maybe positions of arguments and positions of operators, and the notion of improper moves. These are topics that could be of interest for professional reasons.
Who is for the first? Who is for the more technical one? For the second one? Well, then I propose that you start with the more general and you see how people react. Then you can go over to more complicated things. Fine. Thank you very much. It will take place this afternoon at 6:30, about that. I will tell you in the afternoon in which room will take place this meeting. Professor Chomsky has lost his voice. Almost, not completely. He's not completely voiceless, but he will help himself with this microphone. Sessions will run, as you know, from 10:30 to about 12:30 in the morning, from 4 to 6 in the afternoon. It includes his talk and discussion. Professor Chomsky, we are gathered here many different people, linguists, philosophers, psychologists, and scientists from many kinds, not just from Catalan universities, but from all over Spain. As I told you when you arrived yesterday night, it's a pleasure and a great, great honor for us that you came to this year. Thank you very much.
Thank you. You can tablet, if you want, can tablet.
Well, I'm kind of hoping that as the adrenaline starts to flow, the voice will pick up. Can you hear me in the back? Yeah. Okay. If it gets better, I'll put this aside and just talk, but we'll see what happens. And I presume that by tomorrow or so, it'll be improved. Incidentally, in general, if you would like to raise questions or objections or bring up points or whatever, please feel free to do so, even more than usual, because it gives me a chance to rest my voice while I listen to you. So at any point in the course of discussion, if you can't hear or you don't understand or you think it's completely wrong or you have some other idea, don't hesitate to interrupt. If I feel that it's taking us too far off the track that I'd like to get to, I'll ask to put it aside and come back, or otherwise we can simply go on. I'm going to follow pretty much the course that was suggested for Luigi, start at a fairly general level and proceed towards more specific questions and issues as time and as shared interest permits and suggests. I want to talk about what is called the cognitive revolution that began in the 1950s. When I suggested the topic, I also suggested that quotes be put around the word cognitive revolution, suggesting a certain skepticism about its revolutionary character. The skepticism has two aspects to it. One, I'm not convinced that it was as much of a change as many other people think. In my opinion, in many ways, it picked up and recovered ideas, even technical ideas, that are much older, that we can trace to what might be called. And it didn't always improve on those. In fact, in some cases, I think there's been regression. So it's not, in my opinion, as revolutionary as it has been held to be. The earlier tradition had been entirely forgotten by the 1950s. Even in scholarship, it was not known and not understood. That is, scholars knew the books, but they didn't understand what was in them. In my opinion, that's still more or less the case. I don't think that the riches of the first cognitive revolution have yet been appreciated or understood, except in certain corners of scholarship. The second aspect of skepticism is that my own feeling is that the cognitive revolution has taken, from the very beginning, a rather dubious path, maybe a wrong turn. And that the directions in which it's proceeding should be seriously reassessed from their very origins. And here I would go back further, in this case of the study of language and mind, back, say, to Frege, where I think already there are some intellectual moves made in the study of language and mind that are quite dubious and that have had questionable effects, in my view, negative effects on contemporary theory of reference and many other topics. Now, when I speak of the cognitive revolution, I don't mean to be referring to specific work in, say, the neurophysiology of vision or the study of reasoning under complex conditions and so on. A lot of that work is very respectable scientific work. I'm thinking of the more reflective and considered aspects of the cognitive revolution, those that fall roughly within philosophy of mind, or the parts of the so-called artificial intelligence that are concerned with the general nature of the issues, rather than constructing an expert system that will solve some technical engineering problem and so on. So I'm really thinking about, when I refer to the cognitive revolution with skepticism, it's at the general level. It's where it intersects with, and in fact falls under, one might say, contemporary philosophy of mind and philosophy of language. Well, that's the skepticism. I'll come back to trying to fill in the blanks. Are you still hearing me? Yes. Okay. If not, wave your arms or something. The study of language and mind, as everyone knows, goes back several millennia, back to classical antiquity. It's often been assumed that these two inquiries, the inquiries into language and into mind, are intimately related, that language is a mirror of mind, as Leibniz put it. If that is the case, then the study of language should provide unique insight into human thought, and that's often been thought to be the case over the last several thousand years. So there have been repeated convergences between the more technical study of language and the more general study of mental events, actions, and processes, and so on. Now, this convergence has taken place in these two cognitive revolutions. It took place about 40 years ago at the origins of what is today commonly called the cognitive revolution, and contemporary linguistics, the linguistics as most of us know it and practice it, developed as part of that cognitive revolution, and in fact has been a significant factor, maybe a major factor, in the development of cognitive science since the modern origins. And this same convergence, in fact, took place during what I called the first cognitive revolution of the 17th century, which was in fact part of the general scientific revolution of the period, the Galilean Revolution. The convergence took place in ways which are rather strikingly similar to the convergence of the 1950s in a number of respects. One respect was the stimulus to the scientific imagination that was by automata. Now, in the 20th century, of course, it's been computers. In the 17th and 18th century, it was the remarkable automata that were constructed by skilled craftsmen, starting with extremely complicated clocks and reaching up to the creations of people like Jacques de Vaucanson, you know, a duck digesting food and that sort of thing. And these automata, in both cases, both in the 17th and 18th century and currently in contemporary discussion, the apparent achievements of artifacts raised an obvious question, namely whether humans are not simply more complex machines, more complex artifacts. That was a topic of very lively debate then, as it is today. Now, the Cartesians, notoriously, the Cartesians offered a negative answer to this position. They said, no, humans are not more complex artifacts, although Descartes tried to show that a very substantial part of what humans do, including all the way up to perception and sensation, is just a complex watch or a complex machine. And the same is true, he argued, of all of the entire inorganic world and the entire organic world, up to the level of, metaphorically speaking, we might say humans below the neck. You know, I mean, that is a metaphor, of course. but he also argued that certain aspects of human intelligence lie beyond the scope of any conceivable artifact. And he appealed specifically to language in this connection. That's where the convergence took place. Crucially, if you look at, say, Discourse on Method and other Cartesian discussions, he appealed to normal aspects of language use as evidence of the kind of phenomena that in principle could not be incorporated within an automaton, even of the most complex and highly articulated kind. Specifically, he referred to a collection of properties that normal linguistic behavior manifests. We can call them, though he didn't call them this, we can call them the creative aspect of language use. Let me call them that. This is a collection of properties which includes the fact that normal language use, I don't mean poetic discourse, just ordinary interaction among people, is unbounded. People are always saying new things and hearing new things that have never been said before in the history of human species. And this goes on constantly and unrecognizably. You have no way of knowing, in fact, whether they're new or not, because they all sound familiar, even if you've never heard anything like them before. So normal speech is unbounded. On the other hand, it's obviously not random. It's not just some device producing things with a random element in it. It's coherent. It's appropriate to situations. On the other hand, it doesn't seem to be caused by situations. In fact, it appears to be completely uncaused. That's not to say that there aren't influences, but it seems to be a paradigm example of the general matter of freedom of the will. If you had a complete description of your internal state and of the surroundings that you're in, still, the Cartesians argued, and phenomenally they seem to be correct, still you could choose to say something other than what is suggested, maybe even strongly pressured by the internal state and the external environment. Like, I could right now start talking about the weather in Boston, let's say, or any other topic, and I'm not going to do it because it would be inappropriate, but I could perfectly well do it, and it would be completely coherent, and I could find topics that none of you would be able to even understand, you know, what's happening in my family or something like that. And all of that's always possible, and we know that it's possible. Even given my internal state completely described and my surroundings completely described, I can start doing anything. This, of course, is a much more general problem. As the Cartesians emphasized, in their formulation, a machine is compelled to act in a certain way, up to randomness. Up to randomness, a machine is compelled to act in a certain way by the arrangement of its parts and the stimulus situation. A human being, in contrast, is only incited or inclined to act in a certain way and may choose not to. It may choose in a way to act in a way contrary to its inclinations. So you can choose to act, say, suicidally, and people sometimes do, or in all sorts of other ways. That kind of phenomenon, which is manifested most clearly in the normal use of language, Descartes argued, lies beyond the bounds of any possible automaton. So the fact that language is unbounded, stimulus-free, not determined by internal state, even though heavily influenced by it, appropriate situations, but not caused by situations, in fact, apparently uncaused, not random, evoking thoughts in others that they might have expressed the same way as they understand once they hear the expression. That collection of properties, call it the creative aspect of language use, is, Descartes argued, kind of a litmus test, just as litmus test is a test for acidity. These properties are a test for some other aspect of the world, for some property of the world that does not fall within mechanism. Now, those arguments are not inconsiderable, and I don't think they change at all as we move from the complex artifacts that excited the imagination of the Cartesians to the contemporary artifacts that we use, contemporary computers, although they're radically different in all sorts of respects. Exactly the same reasoning applies. The difference between appropriateness to situations and caused by situations, appropriate use versus random, arbitrary intrusion into deterministic systems, that seems to remain. The automata that we have are either deterministic or have elements of randomness. They could be then probabilistic in their behavior, but none of that matches in the least the properties of ordinary human behavior, so it appears. Now, we could be completely wrong about this. Maybe we're being misled about the facts, but these facts, as the Cartesians argued, seem as obvious to us as anything could be on immediate inspection. And as Descartes again argued, it would be absurd to deny that which appears obvious to us, since we, simply on the grounds that we may not have intelligence enough, or at least we do not now have intelligence enough to understand it. That would simply be irrational. And he therefore argued, and I think we're still in this situation, that we have to take these things very seriously. Well, that was the Cartesian response to the first question, the question whether people are simply more complex automata. their argument was, yeah, everything is just a complex automaton except certain aspects of human behavior, language being a paradigm case. Those issues again arose in the second cognitive revolution and the contemporary debate about the Turing test and the kinds of things, say, that Roger Penrose, for example, looks at in his recent book, if you've seen that, and so on. The vast debate about the Chinese room, Searle's Chinese room in the philosophy of mind and artificial intelligence literature. All of this is a contemporary version of it. In my view, a case of regression, however. I think it's extremely misguided, seriously misguided. Whereas as the question arose in the 17th century, it was a very sensible question. Maybe the answers didn't make any sense, but the question was sensible and the framework sensible. I'll try to suggest later that the contemporary framework makes no sense whatsoever and is completely off track. And in fact, in my opinion, Turing, in his original paper in 1950, already pointed out why it was off track. That is, it's been following a line that he suggested people not follow, but I'll come back to that. If you don't know what I'm talking about, I'll come back and fill in these details later. Well, a second similarity between the first and the second cognitive revolution is that in both cases there was great interest in computational theories of the mind. In fact, the great scientific achievement of Descartes, his major contribution to modern science, was the development of a computational theory of vision. He overthrew prevailing neo-scholastic theories of vision, which had a very mystical character to them, kind of common sense in a way, but mystical. At the time, it was assumed that, say, if you see a cube, if I see a cube rotating in space, there's a cube rotating in space in my brain. Okay, so somehow the form of the thing out there, by some mysterious process, gets into my brain and it's in there. And that's what vision is. It's picking up the form of the object and duplicating it somehow. But Descartes ridiculed this idea properly and offered, not only tried to show why it was absurd, but offered an alternative theory. The alternative theory that he presented was a real scientific breakthrough. You can't use it in his form, but it led to modern neurophysiology, modern biology, the modern biology of cognitive processes. He asked, in order to undermine this view, he suggested that we consider the case of a blind man with a stick who's tapping on some object in front of him with the stick, say a chair, and he's getting a sequence of stimuli in his hand. And from this sequence of stimuli, he sort of figures out that it's a chair that he's perceiving. Well, obviously, the image of the chair isn't getting into his brain. The only thing that's getting into his brain are some pressures against his fingers. And so there's a sequence of pressures on the fingers from which his mind is somehow constructing the image of a chair. Well, Descartes argued that that's exactly what normal vision is. In fact, given Cartesian physics, he had to assume that there's a solid connection between the retina and an object that you see. There's like a rod, a rigid rod that extends from your eye to the thing you see. And as you move your eye around, it's exactly like tapping on a chair with a stick. It just happens to be that you're getting stimuli on your retina instead of in your hand, but the picture's the same. And he therefore argued that normal vision is just the computational interpretation by the mind, by the brain. In fact, this is automata for him, so by the brain, of a sequence of pressures on the retina, which is exactly like what the blind man is doing. Well, that leads to a kind of a computational theory of vision. It's the inner resources of the mind that determine what you see. So he argued he didn't do the experiment, but we could do the experiment now, and his guess was right. He argued that if you take an infant who's never seen a geometrical figure, let's say, and you present the infant with a triangle, like I draw a triangle on the board, what the child will see is a distorted Euclidean triangle, because of course what you've drawn is not a real triangle. I mean, two of the lines don't quite come together and one of them's got a curve and so on. The child, in other words, will not perceive a perfect example of what it is, which is some crazy, completely crazy figure, but it will see it as a distorted triangle, even though it's never had any experiences. And the reason, Descartes argued, this is a thought experiment, of course, but it's correct. You know, the reason he argued is that the mind operates by the principles of Euclidean geometry, and when a sequence of stimuli hit the retina, the child's mind creates the Euclidean, you know, the abstract figure, and that's what's seen. And then you sort of notice that what's out there is kind of a distorted version of it. And he argued this is true generally of perception. That whole picture seems essentially correct, and it's been picked up. It in fact, was a scientific breakthrough and led the way to a serious inquiry into the biology of vision and perception generally. In fact, that, I suppose, is Descartes', well, at least one of his leading scientific contributions. It opens up modern physiology. Now, similar ideas have reemerged in the 20th century cognitive revolution and have led to quite a productive work in some of the same areas that were, in fact, strikingly the very same areas that were explored in the 17th century, primarily vision and a few other sensory modalities and language. And a little bit in other areas, conceptual development, reasoning, and so on. In the area of language, the Cartesian revolution did lead at once to efforts to apply this kind of computational point of view. It wasn't regarded then as computational. We would regard it as computational. This computational point of view, which views a mechanical device from a certain abstract perspective. That's about what it amounts to, you know, where it's doing, it's carrying out. We view it as having the property of a computational device. That's a collection of states and properties that a device could have. So this account that I gave of the infant seeing the triangle could be redescribed as a kind of a software matter, if you like. That conception reemerged and somewhat reformulated in the 20th century. In the Cartesian period, it set off quite important studies of language, in fact, revolutionary studies, developing what was then called rational and philosophical grammar, which just means rational and philosophical just means scientific in our term. So that would be scientific linguistics. It led to a conception of universal grammar, meaning properties of language that are common to language generally, not to specific languages. And of course, that would be a core part of any scientific approach to the study of language or anything else. It also led to the first real studies of the vernacular. That was kind of unusual at the time. You weren't supposed to study Latin or something like that. But there were direct, for the first time, serious investigations of actual languages that people speak. The vernacular languages, French, for example. The very fact that Descartes wrote in French was considered remarkable and a real breakthrough. And this has all sorts of political aspects to it as well. All of these were important achievements, later forgotten, but reconstructed in many ways in the 20th century cognitive revolution. Well, the second cognitive revolution has indeed led to real advances in certain areas. Strikingly, the old areas, vision, language, a couple of others, I mentioned a few. It's not so clear, to me at least, that it has led to any real progress at what you might consider a second level, the level of reflection about the nature of the disciplines that are concerned with what was traditionally called mental acts and faculties, and that's the question that I want to come back to as I proceed. Some of these questions are substantive, some historical. Let me just start with a couple of words about the second cognitive revolution, the one in the 1950s, the one that contemporary linguistics was part of and came out of, and then go back to a kind of a general look at the whole topic. None of these things have a starting date, of course, but George Miller, who was one of the leading figures in the current birth, or I would say rebirth, of cognitive psychology. He, in a retrospective talk on this recently, traced the cognitive revolution, as it's often called, to a meeting that took place in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I've forgotten whether it was at Harvard or MIT, in 1956. It was a meeting of the Institute of Radio Engineers, the IRE. And in fact, most of this work developed within an electrical engineering framework in the 1950s. At that meeting, there were several, there was a kind of an unexpected convergence of different things, you know, which in retrospect, you could say, he argued, set off the cognitive revolution, or at least sort of gave it some kind of form. There were papers on human information processing, human psychology, using new ideas like signal detection theory and information theoretic ideas and so on. There was a collection of papers on those topics. There was the first paper on generative grammar that had been given publicly, a paper of mine, which sort of outlined some of the basic ideas that later became generative grammar. There was also an important paper on problem solving and reasoning that was by Newell and Simon. I don't recall anymore which one of them gave the paper, but Alan Newell and Herb Simon gave their first exposition of their paper on a program for proving theorems in elementary logic, which was one of the things that set off contemporary artificial intelligence. I should say that Newell and Simon didn't follow the path that became conventional, but this kind of set things off and was considered a major, if not breakthrough, at least stimulus to contemporary artificial intelligence, which hadn't really been formulated yet at that time. Well, that was a collection of papers. They came from different sources. They proceeded in different ways. There had not really been much communication among the people who'd given them. Actually, they were even given in different sessions. But they had some shared ideas, and that was sort of obvious at once. One shared idea was a certain kind of shift in perspective that was common to all of them, a shift in perspective from what we might call an externalist point of view to an internalist point of view. That is, the psychology of the time, study of humans of the time, was externalist in that it was concerned with what's outside the person. It was concerned with behavior, that is, what, you know, some action that's going on, or maybe the products of behavior. So linguistics was the study of products of behavior, was the study of texts, sounds, words, you know, arrangements of words, structures of sounds. And that was true of both European structuralism and American structuralism, different in many respects, but both of them externalist in this respect. Behavior is psychology, paradigm example. You're only interested in what's outside the mind. In fact, it's a kind of a point of principle that you're not supposed to look at anything else. The shift that took place was from this externalist point of view to an internalist one, in which what you're interested in is precisely what's going on inside the mind brain, inside the mind, where we think of the mind now as just some set of properties and states and processes of the brain, ultimately to be related to the brain sciences in some fashion. So use the term mind, but without any metaphysical implications. The topic of inquiry shifts totally. Instead of the topic of inquiry being behavior and the products of behavior, the topic of inquiry is what's going on inside the mind. Behavior and products of behavior are just data, and not particularly privileged data. I mean, if they happen to be useful, okay. Data in itself is of no, you know, you never know whether it's any good or not. Data becomes significant when it becomes evidence. Evidence is a relational concept, evidence for, you know. So data moves into the sciences when it becomes evidence for something. And the something is something about the nature of the world, in this case, the nature of the mind. In my opinion, this shift is a shift from sort of natural history or, you know, rock collecting or something like that to the beginnings of what might turn out to be science. It's kind of a shift from natural history to natural science, where data and the products of behavior and of behavior and the products of behavior are simply data, useful if they're useful, otherwise throw them out. Most data are useless, and not particularly privileged. If you could find evidence from, say, electrical stimulation of the brain that would tell you something about language, that's just as good, maybe better, than evidence about, you know, the way people interpret sentences or what they do with words or whatever. Data is just data. It's of no interest in itself. Well, that's you know, it's intellectually speaking, that was an enormous shift. And it was very controversial. And indeed, it remains very controversial today. In fact, if you take such criteria as, let's say, government funding, for whatever that's worth, overwhelmingly government funding, at least in the United States, goes to the externalist work, the statistical analysis of texts, you know, organization of data, you know, that kind of thing. Very little of it goes to the internalist work, which is, in my view, the only kind that even merits being talked about seriously, other than maybe for some engineering application, which rather low-level engineering application that might be useful. Anyhow, that's a personal view. But it was clearly a shift of perspective, and it was taking place at one or another level in all of this work. And I don't want to exaggerate, because among many of the people in the cognitive sciences, they regard this shift of perspective as dubious or wrong. But at least there were hints of it in all of this work, and you can see, maybe better in retrospect, that a move was taking place in that direction. Again, in my opinion, that's a move from natural history, rather boring natural history, to a potential natural science. Maybe it's not there yet, but you can at least see how it might emerge. A second set of shared ideas in this range of papers at this IRE convention was in what you might call computational representational theories. That is, looking at mental activities and mental faculties, what the brain is doing, in other words, looking at it as a kind of software problem. Now, to look at it as a software problem is to take a certain abstract perspective toward the functioning of the machine. You know, it's a perspective that sometimes makes sense, sometimes doesn't make sense. Whenever you're studying some physical object, sometimes a particular abstract perspective makes sense, gives you insight, sometimes it doesn't. That's what science is about. And in this case, there was a kind of an intuitive shared feeling, with anybody saying it, that viewing the brain as abstractly, of course it's purely abstract, as having hardware properties and software properties would be useful. Now remember, this is totally abstract. I mean, even if you look at, even in the case of a computer, we distinguish hardware and software, but you know, you can't pull out a particular piece of the computer and say I'm hardware. I mean, everything is just hardware. You know, to say that a computer is implementing some software is to view it from a certain abstract perspective, which may make sense or may not make sense. And in the case of the brain, the questions may make sense or may not make sense, much as looking at the planets in terms of kind of rational mechanics, in which, you know, you have mass points observing Newton's laws or something, may make sense or may not make sense. It's a matter of to be discovered, not to be stipulated. Now, this point of view was kind of liberating, as it had been in the 17th century. Now, in the 17th century, they didn't talk about hardware and software. But again, in retrospect, I think it makes a lot of sense to reinterpret Descartes' overthrow of the neo-scholastic theory of vision in terms of the picture that I just presented as, in effect, adopting a computational representational point of view and separating the software aspects, the computational aspects, which give you these idealized figures and so on, from the hardware properties, like the sequence of stimuli on the finger or the brain and so on. And in fact, in contemporary work, it's often looked like that. So if you read, say, you know, work in the David Marr School, for example, the distinction is made quite explicit and correctly. I mean, it's led to a lot of progress. which is the only mark of correctness. Now, this is a double-edged sword, in my opinion. I think the move to the position where you look at mental problem activities as software problems was liberating, and you know, it was a move that should have been made. On the other hand, it can also be extremely misleading. And in my opinion, it has long become more misleading than helpful, particularly in philosophy of mind. In fact, here again, I think that the current, especially those areas of philosophy of mind that are kind of around artificial intelligence, including inquiry into Turing tests and so on, have been seriously misled by the metaphors. I'll come back to that. So, you know, analogies and metaphors and abstractions are okay, but you don't want to make sure that you don't get carried away by them into directions where you shouldn't follow them, and that's never easy to know, of course. Well, that's the general background that I have in mind. I'll try to fill it in as we proceed. Let me now approach the question from an even more general point of view, if you like. Are you still hearing me back there? Yeah? Okay. Well, I'm still being able to articulate, so I'll continue. Let me now try to approach this from another perspective, you know, kind of orthogonal, and ask how one might proceed to study human beings altogether. Well, there's one obvious idea. An obvious idea is that you should study human beings as if they're part of the natural world. That would seem kind of obvious, surely controversial traditionally, contrary to religious teachings and all sorts of other things. But in the, say, post-Galilean period, it should be possible to entertain the idea that you should study human beings as part of the natural world. Now, that doesn't mean that when you study human beings, you're going to find what you find when you study rocks, obviously. But that's normal. It just means that the method of approach should be as if they're part of the natural world. Meaning, what you should do is search for intelligible explanatory theories that give you some insight into what these objects are about and what they're up to and how they're constituted. And you should hope, as in the other areas of the natural sciences, you should hope that ultimately this inquiry will be integrated with other aspects of the natural sciences. Typically, over the centuries, parts of the natural sciences proceed in isolation. You don't know how to integrate them with one another. And when you can integrate them, it's a big discovery. So when, say, you know, biology was sort of more or less incorporated in biochemistry about 40 years ago, that's a real breakthrough. When it became possible for physics to understand for the first time such things as why a solid object can exist, which was sort of incomprehensible to the physics of the 19th century, when it became possible to understand, to kind of incorporate within physics elementary properties of the world, like states of matter, or the properties of solids, or the color of sodium, or the character of the periodic table, in other words, the quantum theoretic revolution, that's a real revolution. No. Nevertheless, quite often in normal science, things just can't be integrated because you don't know how to integrate them, so they proceed separately with an eye to eventual integration. That's normal science. I mean, you get these miraculous moments when things get integrated, but it's not the norm by any means. This approach that says let's study humans the way we study anything else, let's call it naturalistic. By calling it naturalistic, I mean to try to focus attention on the character of work and reasonable goals, and to abstract away from the question of success. So maybe it's completely unsuccessful. That's another issue. So I don't want to use the honorific term science for it, but just like science, you know, in the way it works. By calling the work naturalistic, that's what I mean. I want to abstract away from questions of actual success. That's a kind of a common sense idea. A naturalistic approach would claim that it has no burden of proof to meet at all. It's self-justifying. It need give no justification. Maybe there's some reason not to adopt a naturalistic point of view to humans, but that's what needs justification. You'd have to give an argument for that. So the burden of proof is on anyone who questions this idea. So a naturalistic picture would assume. And I think that that's correct. Unless there's some reason to the contrary, I've never heard one. It seems to me we should agree that unless some argument is given, which hasn't yet been given, There's no reason not to study humans the way we would study rocks or bees or anything else, expecting to discover totally different things, of course, as when we study solids and liquids, we discover totally different things. Well, there are questions, interesting questions, as to how naturalistic inquiry ought to proceed. So what are the criteria of rationality for science, and what about the reality of theoretical entities, and does it make sense to claim that a vector field, which is a mathematical object, has mass, and so on and so forth? I mean, there are such questions, all kind of interesting questions. But now, if one is interested in getting answers to those questions, not just harassing emerging disciplines, then the place to ask the questions is where there might be a chance of getting an answer. And that's the way you proceed if you're rational. You have some question you'd like to answer. You look at the area where you might find an answer. Now, in this case, that means physics, not psychology. You're not going to find any answers to these questions in psychology. You might find some answers in physics for just the obvious reason. The depth of understanding and the degree of success is so qualitatively greater, you know, by orders of magnitude, that there really are guides to inquiry into these questions. Whereas in the emerging disciplines, you have half time, you don't know what you're doing at all. You know, so there's just going to be nothing around that's going to guide inquiry. I mean, if you would ask these questions in physics in the Galilean period, you would have gotten all wrong answers. We know that. In fact, you know, Galileo had a very hard time convincing anyone, and had a rather sad fate, precisely because not enough was understood about these questions, so that what he was trying to do was intelligible. I mean, you can only get some insight where there's been some advances. So therefore, the attempt to raise these questions about fields like psychology and linguistics seems to me just a form of harassment. It's of no intellectual interest. Now, you can understand why philosophers do it. Quantum physics is hard. You want to raise questions about quantum physics, you got to study hard, and you got to learn things, and you got to think about things, and so on. If you want to raise questions about psychology, you can do it off the top of your head, because nothing much is known, so it makes life easier. But that's not a good reason to harass psychology, I don't think. So insofar as these general questions arise, I think we can dismiss them. General questions about, unless some special reason is shown to show that psychology and linguistics, you know, have some special methodological problem that, say, physics doesn't have, unless that's an argument like that can be given, general questions about, say, induction or indeterminacy or all of these things, we can forget about. They all arise in physics, and if anything arises in physics, we can forget about it. If you want to get an answer to the question, look over there where they really understand something and there might be some hope of moving forward. There's some insight. There's no point raising these questions here where so little is understood. So I'll put those aside unless there's an argument. Incidentally, this throws out, by this decision, I've thrown out an awful lot of contemporary philosophy, maybe unfairly, but I think fairly. A lot of it, in my view, is just harassment of emerging discipline. So let's put that aside. And the criterion I want to use is this, to restate it. If some general methodological consideration can be shown to hold of language and psychology, but not of chemistry and geology, then we'll consider it. But if it holds of chemistry and geology, we'll forget about it. Okay, that's the working criterion that I'd like to suggest, and I think it's a rational one, based on the assumption that if we ask questions, we do it because we want answers, not because we're trying to harass somebody. If we want answers, we'll look at the place where we might find answers. That's the logic of the criterion I'm suggesting. Well, a naturalistic approach to humans, then, will put aside any general methodological issues that just arise in the course of rational inquiry generally, and will simply take for granted what is done in normal science with all of its uncertainties and equivocations and problems, always with an open mind, of course, like, you know, maybe somebody will come up with a real methodological question. And then it will proceed to study humans in the way that you study anything else. Try to find an intelligible explanatory theory that gives you some insight and opens up new paths of investigation and leads to new kinds of empirical questions you hadn't thought about before, and so on, that sort of thing. Well, that's the naturalistic approach. An alternative approach which rejects naturalism, we might call, although I'll qualify this, let's call it dualistic. A dualistic approach says that humans just aren't part of the natural world, and you have to study them in some quite different way. Now, here we have to be a little more careful, because a naturalistic approach could lead to a certain kind of dualism. So, for example, Cartesian metaphysical dualism, in my view, was completely naturalistic. That is, it was the outcome of a way of looking at human beings naturalistically, and it led to a conception that humans have some special property, just like acids have some special property that bases don't have. There's nothing dualistic about chemistry, because it says acids are different from bases, and you can tell the difference by a litmus test. And there's nothing non-naturalistic about Cartesian metaphysical dualism if it says that there's some special property that humans above the neck have, and there's a litmus test for it, namely things like the creative aspect of language use. I mean, that can be wrong, but it's not non-naturalistic. So dualism, I don't mean dualism and naturalism to be exclusive categories. There's a form of dualism, namely metaphysical dualism, the traditional form, which could follow from a naturalistic approach and could even be right. You know. In fact, let's have a look at how it... So the kind of... What I mean by sort of pernicious dualism, irrational dualism, is a kind of epistemological dualism, not metaphysical. One that says we're not allowed to study human beings the way we study other things. There's a law which I state, which says you're not allowed to approach humans by the same procedures of rational inquiry that you apply elsewhere. That may seem to be a crazy point of view, and I mean to suggest that it is indeed a crazy point of view. But I'll also suggest that it's the overwhelmingly dominant one in philosophy of mind and cognitive science. In fact, maybe almost universal. So I want to take a strong position on that controversial position. So therefore, I'm putting it in the craziest possible form. And then what I'll try to argue is that the actual, what actually is done, in fact, falls under this rubric. That's the path I want to follow, just to look ahead. Well, all right, let's go back to traditional dualism. And say, take the Cartesian form, traditional Cartesian metaphysical dualism, and remember the way it worked. In outline, Descartes argued sort of as follows. He had a conception of the physical world. He gave a conception of physics. The conception of physics is what was called in those days the mechanical philosophy. Philosophy is just a word for science. So philosophy means science. So the mechanical philosophy meant mechanics. And mechanics was kind of a common sense mechanics. It was a sort of contact mechanics. Things can influence one another if they're in contact. That's the crucial idea. Like I can't move the moon by moving my arm, let's say, because they're not in contact. That's just common sense. It happens to be wrong, but it's common sense. Okay. So that's common sense contact mechanics. And Descartes gave a kind of sketchy account. I mean, it's not a detailed account. But a sort of sketchy account of how you might cover all of the phenomena he claimed of the inorganic world, the organic world, most of things about humans, everything except these few things that I mentioned, in terms of the mechanical philosophy, in terms of a kind of contact mechanics. Well, all of that's... And then he said, look, here's these phenomena that are around, like creative aspect of language use, which don't fall under this. Therefore, we need a new principle, completely rational. We need a new principle because they're not covered by the mechanical philosophy. Within his framework, the only way to set up a new principle was to introduce a new substance, but that's part of the framework with which he approached it. So you introduce a res cogitans, another principle, thinking substance, which has other properties. And then from a naturalistic point of view, you have two questions. First of all, what's its character? What is it? What is the res cogitans. Nobody actually knows whether Descartes had an answer to this. If you look at his major book, the Traité du Monde, this big study of the world, there's only three volumes. There was a fourth volume which was supposedly devoted to the mind, and legend has it that he destroyed that volume after he heard what happened to Galileo. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. Maybe all the secrets are in there, like Fermat's last theorem or something. But in any event, there's nothing much around from the theory of mind. But that would have been the problem. One problem would have been, okay, if you've got this separate substance, tell us what it is. The second problem would be the standard unification problem that arises in the sciences altogether, that is show how this theory relates to other theories. Now, in the terminology of that day, it meant solve the interaction problem, show how mind and body interact. You know, that's the way in which the standard unification problem of normal science is stated in terms of a two-substance theory of the structure of science. And remember, a two-substance theory of science is perfectly rational. I mean, it may be completely wrong again, but most theories have always been wrong. There's nothing irrational about it. We can, I think, without doing serious violence to, in fact, maybe even providing some understanding to the history, rethink it in this form. So we have a naturalistic approach which claims to show that a whole range of phenomena of the world fall under contact mechanics, so identify some phenomena that don't fall into it, invokes a new principle, then should proceed to study that new principle, developing a theory of mind, which would be like a theory of chemistry or genes or something, and then solve the unification problem, show how it falls in with other parts of the theory of the world. And it looks as if that's what Descartes was trying to do in Principles of Philosophy and Traité du Monde and all that sort of stuff. These are the parts of Descartes that nobody ever reads. The parts of Descartes that people read are things like Discourse on Method, which was like a research grant proposal. I mean, it wasn't serious. He was saying, look, support me, I want to work on this topic. Or the Meditations, where he's trying to answer questions that philosophers raised about all this. But from Descartes' point of view, as much as you can reconstruct, it seems that what was important was the science, you know, dioptrics, things like that. And the other stuff was thinking about the nature of the science. Well, since the science is mostly, in fact, almost all, maybe all, outmoded, you know, you don't study it. But for that matter, nobody much studies Galileo either, because it's done differently and better. But that doesn't mean that it wasn't important to him, you know. What remains is the talk about the science. And since there's been no progress in that at all, you can make perfectly good sense to read, say, Discourse on Method. But I think one should read it recognizing that for Descartes, this is peripheral. It's not central. If you want to understand the project, you have to look at it his way. When you reconstruct it his way, I think you find a very naturalistic project, which ends up with metaphysical dualism as a serious proposal. Serious proposal about the nature of the world, which could very well turn out to be right, like other serious proposals about the nature of the world. Well, so again, this is dualism, but it's not non-naturalistic. It's naturalistic dualism. Maybe wrong, but naturalistic within the spirit of science. Well, all of this has been ridiculed, especially in the modern period, as the idea that there's, as Gilbert Ryle put it, a ghost in the machine, and then you're supposed to laugh. There's a ghost in the machine. Isn't that silly? But that mistakes the problem completely.